You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
And welcome. You are watching, listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm your host, Carrie Lutz. Well, got a great guest for you today, someone who can help you optimize your money flow. In fact, he's written a book called Optimal Money Flow. And unlike many financial people who you hear who will kind of ignore the macro situation, ignore the money printing and all of that, and just concentrate on growth stocks, Dr. Larry Marsh, professor, really concentrates on turning that to your advantage. And I will welcome you, Dr. Marsh, and hey, tell us, how do you make the Fed work for you instead of against you?
Well, it's interesting to note that while our economy grows at only an average of about 3% a year with lots of ups and downs, the stock market on average, also with lots of ups and downs, grows at 10% a year. Well, you say, how can it be that the market, the stock market can grow over three times faster than the economy as a whole? And what has happened over the decades is the Fed has actually pumped lots of money into the financial markets. It tries to manipulate the real economy through the financial economy, but the financial economy has become more and more separated from the real economy. But what I do then is I look to the markets as a area where you can really benefit from compound interest. But you need a long time horizon. So if you're already 50 or 55 years old, it's going to be really hard to take advantage of that. But if you've got a young child and you put $1,000 when that child is born into the markets, then you can have that one occurrence of putting $1,000 and checking reinvest dividends, you can have over $1 million by the time the child is 70, 75 years old. That $1,000 will have turned into $1 million through compound interest. So there's a real advantage of being a long-term player in the stock market. And I always recommend the broad market index funds like Schwab's SEHB, or Vanguard's VTI, or iShares iTote, and just checking off reinvest dividends and playing the long game with the market and not trying to time things. There may be some professionals that can do good market timing, but for most investors, being a long-term player is what really pays off. I am very wary of cash. I think this can be a mistake to get into cash because my basic philosophy, and my father was a Wall Street investment banker, so I learned very early on how the market works, but that the market will go up and down, up and down, up and down, and then shoot up. And then it'll go up and down, up and down, up, and then shoot up. And if you miss those few periods where it's shooting up, then you miss a great deal of the market return. So I use dividend funds as cash. When I think the market's getting too frothy, I move into dividend funds because they have a much less volatility than the general market. And so that is the basic idea, is to get into those dividend funds when the market's getting really, and if you're a qualified or accredited investor, you can actually, when the market drops really low and you feel that it's kind of bottomed out, you could actually move into leveraged funds. So like instead of Dow, you'd use UDAO, which now I don't do the shorts. SDAO is a little too dangerous, but UDAO does three times whatever the Dow does. The Dow goes up 10%, UDAO goes up 30%. If the Dow, on the other hand, if the Dow goes down 10%, UDAO goes down 30%. So for those that feel confident in their money and feel they have lots of money so they don't have to worry about losing, then these leverage funds can be, with a relatively small part of your portfolio, can be a kind of a fun game to play. The S&P 500 has UPRO that does three times whatever the S&P does. TQQ does three times whatever the NASDAQ 100s do. So there's these leverage funds that you can sometimes use. But in general, I would recommend just these long-term ETFs and leave it at that.
Yeah. Well, those leverage ones are great until the market goes the opposite way, right?
Right, exactly. So you can lose a lot. You have to have a strong stomach to deal with these leverage funds. So I wouldn't recommend that the average person get into them. But if you are already quite wealthy and you want to take a small portion of your portfolio and play around, then the leverage funds are something to look at. But in general, I would stay away from gambling in the market. And in general, develop a frugality mentality. The frugality mentality is really the basis for long-term economic growth. You know, you can either pretend to be rich now or really be rich later, but not both. So
what's the difference?
If you want to drive a fancy car now and you want to have all, you know, it's interesting. I went to, my mother developed tuberculosis when I was a child, so I had to be sent to a boarding school. And the boarding school was quite expensive, but there were a few scholarship kids. And it's interesting that when we have the alumni reunions, it's the scholarship kids that are driving the really fancy cars, and the kids that came from the wealthier families that didn't need the scholarship, they're just driving a regular old car. I'm still driving my 1999 Camry, which has been wonderful. So, you know, when you pretend to be rich and play, you know, the show off game, you actually undermine your long term financial viability. You're much better off being more conservative and playing the long-term game.
All right. So just because the market has increased 10% a year while the broader economy has gone up 3% a year, does that mean it's going to keep doing that indefinitely? Or is there going to be a day of reckoning?
Well, this is a very good question. And I think there may well be a day of reckoning, because what's happened is that non-financial firms have discovered that instead of investing in their own firm and coming up with new and better products and improving their productivity, they find that they can take a big chunk of money and put it into the financial markets and make a lot of money that way. Well, it's undermining our long-term economic growth for our economy as a whole to have a situation where the financial economy has become so much separated from the real economy. So yes, there is a problem with having a financial markets growing at 10% a year when the economy as a whole is only growing at 3% a year. So there may come a day of reckoning. Unfortunately, I can't predict when that might be or when the politicians might recognize what the problem is and start changing things. One of the problems is with corporate boards. The corporate boards are basically the CEO picks people who are CEOs at other companies, and it's kind of like, I'm on your board, you're on my board. Little, you know, I maximize your return, you maximize my return. But more importantly, you don't really, the corporate board often doesn't know what's actually going on in the company, because the CEO wants the board to think what a great job he or she is doing. So the corporate CEO gives the board all sorts of good reports about how wonderful the CEO is doing. But Germany has come up with a solution, which is requiring a certain proportion of the board be represented by company employees. So that's that company employees, some company employees, maybe 40% of the board be represented by company employees. This way, you get representation from product development, you get representation from marketing, you get representation from sales, you get representation from distribution. You actually know what's happening in the company. And one of the amazing books I've read recently, Greg Graves, the former CEO of Burns & McDonnell here in Kansas City, wrote a book called Create Amazing. What happened is Burns & McDonnell used to be just a little construction company in Kansas City, but then it grew into a nationwide engineering company, and then it became a worldwide engineering company. Say, well, how did this happen? Well, all of the stock in Burns & McDonnell is owned by the employees. And when you retire from Burns & McDonnell, you have to cash in your stock before you get the money. But the thing is that it's like a team. Everybody is on everybody else's case to do the best job they can. So you're personally motivated to do a great job as an individual, but you're also motivated to nudge the guy next to you to do a great job as well. And certainly in Burns & McDonnell, it has really paid off big time to have some employee involvement. That doesn't mean that the employees control every decision made. You know, it's not like they vote on every decision made. They still have a standard corporate structure with a CEO, you know, overseeing everything and ultimately making the decisions. But it does mean that they do have they recognize that employees have agency. They're not just another factory input like steel or plastic, that sure. They really have agency. And you need to exploit that agency and motivate them under the free market system to have agency.
Right. They're going to be acting like owners rather than employees. And the UPS, once upon a time, before they went public, that was the same structure they had. The employees basically got shares. The longer you were there, many, many millionaires. And then when you left, you had to sell your shares back, I believe. And the other company that comes to mind that's still private is Publix Supermarkets. Publix, they get more money than any other supermarket chain here in Florida. But you walk in there, everybody's a team member. They almost all of them greet you. They're happy. And it's a team. And so really, these companies going public can destroy that spirit, the core.
Yeah. And the other thing is that it's so important to be aimed at the customer, understanding the needs of the customer and responding to changes. And so if you go back and you look at Apple Computer, which is then became Apple Inc., then you had Steve Jobs, who was very creative, imaginative entrepreneur, really coming up with new products, exciting products for the... But then they said, well, you know, John Sculley came along and said, you know, you really need a professional manager. You know, it's nice that you're excited about all this stuff, but you really need a professional manager to grow your profit margin and really maximize your short-term share price and so forth. And so Sculley came in, but then, so he was focused on the maximizing shareholder value of the short-term share price. But then the Apple Inc. started losing its competitive advantage to Microsoft and others. And so ultimately they said, no, this is not working. We're losing competitive advantage. So they had to move Sculley out and bring Steve Jobs back in again. And so it shows the importance of focusing on the customer and not getting carried away with the maximizing short-term share price. So that can be a big problem for some corporations.
Oh, yeah. And so what do you think of a company like Tesla?
Well, I think Tesla's a very interesting and exciting company. I admit I'm invested in lithium stocks, although only on a very limited basis, because I'm worried about a transformation of a new battery that doesn't use lithium. So in the short run...
Zinc air batteries, sodium batteries, who knows what they'll come up with.
Yeah, it's hard to know that there could be a breakthrough. As a matter of fact, if we were going to really solve our problem with the climate and all of that, we need a breakthrough in battery technology. That would be probably one of the biggest things that could really help resolve our problems, because storage of solar power and wind power for an extended period with a relatively small battery, inexpensive battery, that would be a huge payoff. So I think that's something to think, to understand in the long run. But on Tesla, I think they're cutting their prices recently was more a recognition that their costs have gone down in their production process, and they can pass some of those along to the customer. And they have been very focused on stimulating the demand for electric cars altogether, that they have shared their technology for recharging the electric vehicles. They've shared a lot of this technology with a broader vision. And this is really pays off. I think we talked about Steve Jobs. We talk about Tesla and these other the entrepreneurs that create these new and amazing things. And they really have a broader vision, and they see where the world is going, and they get out ahead of it. And so I'm a big believer in companies that have a vision well into the future and are not just playing the short-term share price game.
Yeah, certainly Elon Musk is a legend and might be the most important scientist since Nikolai Tesla arrived on the scene 150 years ago.
Wow, good point.
You know, Also cutting the price, like they're the only ones making a profit in EVs, and their margins are higher than any other automaker on the planet. So by them cutting prices, it really sticks the knife in the ribs of the competition and really forces the competition to go back to the drawing board, because Ford is not making any money in EVs. Really, no other company, maybe arguably BYD could be, but you don't really know because they're not pure EV. But anytime, I mean, that was just a huge jolt to the industry, pardon the pun, right? And so pricing, you know, we tend to like discount pricing as a competitive tool in the marketplace. You know, the price is the price is the price until they cut it. And no. I found that whole thing uprooted the industry quite entertaining as a Tesla owner. But, no. You know, just watching it happen.
Don't just survive, thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Fury Gold Mines is a Canada-focused exploration and development company committed to aggressively growing its scalable high-grade gold assets with major drill campaigns planned across its 3.5 million ounce portfolio. Fury is led by a management team of proven explorers and developers with a track record of success in advancing and financing project development. Fury Gold Mines is well positioned to create value for investors with low-risk development growth and the potential for a new major discovery. Fury Gold Mines trades on the TSX and NYSE American under the ticker FURY. To learn more, go to furygoldmines.com. That's furygoldmines.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
Yeah, an interesting strategy, if I could interject, is that in Denmark and Israel and some other places, they have come up with a strategy of where you don't actually own the battery in the car. You buy the car, but you're not buying the battery, you're renting the battery. And the interesting thing is that when you get to the close gas station, instead of getting gas, of course, because you're a pure electric car, they swap out the battery. And that just takes a couple of minutes. And then you're on your way with a different battery. And so they recharge these batteries and just swap them out at these stations. And this allows you to have an infinite range, just like with a gasoline car. You can just keep going. You don't have to wait and recharge your battery.
Yeah, I've seen that unproven, because how many batteries can you stock for how many different cars? Because they're all going to use different batteries. That requires a standardization of battery packs. And also there's issues with the taking something out and putting it back in, wear and tear. But it's an interesting concept that has yet to be proven. If it does work, yes, it will be a game changer. But what will also be a game changer is when you plug your car in and you charge it up and you get 1,000 miles on a charge. That will be the complete game changer. But all these innovative technologies, they have to prove themselves out. Tesla has certainly gone a long ways towards proving it out, but nobody else has been able to replicate their success to date. That doesn't mean that it's not going to happen. But if you're thinking of an EV, my friend told me, I'm going to get an ID4. I said, you know, it doesn't have a frunk, all right, which is the front trunk. And it's gotten horrid reviews from the people that ripped them down, but hey, knock yourself out. Anyway, emerging technology, we don't know who the leader is going to be or if anybody can knock Tesla off its perch. I think my question in asking when I asked you that is really, you know, investment thesis. So let's talk about your book a little bit. What will the average investor get from that book, Professor?
Well, it's very much about what is the role of government in our economy and when is the government involved appropriately and when it's not involved appropriately. And so it's looking at more of an overview. Our patent laws, for example, were introduced with the idea of encouraging innovation, but they've been you know, under Citizens United, where corporations were viewed as people, then they began to have an undue influence, and that enabled them to extend the patents year after year. And so this has undermined the efficiency and undermined innovation instead of encouraging innovation. So we've had a lot of situations where they may have had good intentions initially, but then sometimes it didn't work out. But so the book really is focused a lot on the overall view of the economy and how the economy is works more efficiently when marginal costs and marginal revenues are lined up, and you have lots of externalities. So you have negative externalities, of course, as you know, with air pollution and water pollution and so forth, in which you have to apply the appropriate level of taxes to get them to match. But you also have situations where there's positive externalities, like this pandemic where we had this vaccination. The vaccinations created a positive externality, because if it was a non-contagious disease, there'd be no involvement of the government. They should have no involvement. They just work it out. But when you have a highly contagious disease, it creates these positive externalities where the government, in effect, subsidizes to bring the marginal cost and marginal benefits into alignment. And so the book is really explaining what is the appropriate role of government. When is the government getting in there in an inappropriate way, and when is it in there appropriately? And in understanding that, it'll give you a much better, broader understanding of what's going on in our economy, and will help you in your view of when the economy is operating well and you need to invest in maybe leverage funds or at least in looking for a growing economy, and when things are not going so well and it's time to back off a little bit and get maybe some dividend funds to try to avoid an economic downturn.
All right. So, is this a positive that the government is so intertwined in the economy?
Well, I think it's essential to have the government involved to some degree, because if you think of what would happen if we had no government at all, the free enterprise system would totally collapse. You can look at Haiti or some of these other countries where there's gangs that are running rampant. Obviously, we have to have some government involvement. The question is how much government involvement, and where should the government be involved and where should it not be involved? And that's very important to get that all sorted out.
All right. So should the government be a player in the game on the field, or should they just be the referee, the neutral referee, seeing that the game is played fairly?
Well, sometimes they need to actually get into the game. Now, most of the time they need to just be the referee that makes sure the game is played fairly. But let's take the current situation with inflation. Right now, what are the banks looking at with this inflation? We have to remember, we have a situation where the banks are under they can create their own money. Matter of fact, most of the money that's created in the economy is created by the private banking system. Right. So the problem is that right now the banks are looking at a situation where the Fed is trying to slow the economy, and that we could even go into a recession. So banks at this point want to cut back on their loans. They're not eager to do a lot of loans, and so they have excess reserves. So under fractional reserve banking, when you have excess reserves, you say, "Gee, I really don't want to get people to put more money in my bank because I'm not going to be able to use that money. I've already got more money than I need to create or use, and so I don't want to pay people. So I'd set my savings rate at zero, but I don't want to freak anybody out by doing that. But I'm not going to offer a high rate." So you're not going to get above the 6 or 7% rate of inflation from some bank at this point. So how do you use a return on savings tool to stop the inflation? Well, the only player in the game who can offer 10% on savings would be to go back to what we did in since 1910. The Postal Savings Act of 1910 created these postal savings banks where you could go to any post office and cash a check. You could go to any post office and set up a savings account. Now, they were limited in size. Back then, I think it was like $1,000. You couldn't put in more than $1,000. But the point is If you can offer 10% on savings, you can get at the marginal saver. Now remember, prices are set at the margin, not on the average. So it's really the marginal saver that's setting the inflation rate, the price rate, not the wealthiest of wealthy people. They're just moving their money around, and not the poorest of the poor who can't afford to save anything. It's the marginal saver, the person earning about $50,000 a year, who you need to target to get them to slow the economy, to slow the inflation rate. Now, what the Fed is doing now is actually perverse. They're raising the cost of borrowing. Instead of offering a high return on savings, the Federal Reserve is raising the cost of borrowing. But when you raise the cost of borrowing, you're really raising the cost of loans. Anything like loans, like an automobile or house, the loan rate has gone up. But that just shifts the inflation from things that require a loan to things that don't require a loan. But the way the Fed is really using the cost of borrowing to stop inflation is it's causing businesses that have to borrow money to operate because they have to get the pay for the inputs and process those inputs and then sell them. And so that's a time period in which they need to borrow the money, and then they can pay it back once they are able to sell those products. Like a farmer puts all the effort and the expense in the spring, but doesn't get the money back until harvest time. And then there's retail firms that go run in the red during the year and only cover their expenses and make a profit during the holiday season at the end of the year. So there's all these companies that borrow money in order to operate. When the Fed raises the cost of borrowing, the way it really suppresses demand is through the supply side. It suppresses supply. So it causes firms, by raising the cost of borrowing, it's causing firms to cut hours, lay off workers, and close outlets. Well, you can't spend money you don't have. So workers who have their hours cut or who lose their jobs, they don't have the money to spend. So that suppresses demand and ultimately lowers inflation, but only by suppressing supply. It's much better if instead of using the cost of borrowing tool, you use the return on savings tool and go back to creating these postal savings accounts. And when you do have a perverse situation where the banks have incentives to not offer high rates on savings, matter of fact, they don't even want your money because they are anticipating a recession or a slowing of the economy, that's the time when the Federal Reserve needs to go in. Now, it won't cost the taxpayer a penny, because the Federal Reserve makes profits every year. The Federal Reserve makes like $50 billion up to $80 billion every year. So no taxpayer is paying for the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve makes money out of the financial markets, and it also makes money from all the banks that it works with in the economy. So it's really a self-financed operation. It's not a taxpayer-paid operation. And so when they go into the post office, they could actually rescue the post office financially by having the Federal Reserve operate it rather than have the taxpayer paying for it.
But Professor, you've been to the post office lately? The place is like hanging by a thread. I go to this one near me in Palm Beach County, Florida. There's this one lady, I think she should be an auctioneer. She's like talking like, and nobody, or she should have subtitles. Nobody can understand it. Thing she says, except, you know, she stamps a package and you give her the money. Expanding the responsibilities of an inept federal bureaucracy here. I don't know that that is viable here. Maybe create a new division. It's got to be privately managed. Give Jeff Bezos the post office and let him work with it. He's the biggest user of it anyway. This is a case of the government, failure on a colossal scale. But we appreciate your coming on here. We've got to go now. Just tell us your website and how we get the book.
Okay. The website is, you just type in to your search optimal-money-flow.website. If you type that in, you should be able to find it quite easily. And if you purchase the book through Abilene University Press, the entire $24.95 goes to student scholarships, and I pay for the book, and I pay for the mailing of the book to you. So I've done well in the financial markets, and so I am happy to support student scholarships. I think the cure to crime in our country is college. Send these kids off to college. They can become a nurse, an accountant, an engineer, instead of getting into street gangs and shooting up the urban neighborhoods.
Well, you know what they say, give a man a gun and he can rob a bank. Give, I'm trying to remember the rest of it. I haven't seen it in years. Give a man a bank and he can rob the world.
There you go. Oh, lots of fun.
If you got a question for the good professor, shoot us an email, kl@carrylutz.com. Make sure you check the show notes. You can click through and order the book. It's going to a very worthy cause, for which we applaud you, Professor. And while you're there, sign up for a free newsletter. Professor March, it's been a really interesting conversation. We will talk to you again, I promise you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Carrie.
Thanks for listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.